Calling all Swifties and champions of change, Like a Girl Media is rolling out the red carpet for you with our Thrive Like a Girl contest. We're all about celebrating powerful women leaders who inspire us to dream big and push boundaries. And who embodies that spirit more than Taylor Swift herself? Here's your chance to see her live in concert. We're giving away 2 tickets to Taylor Swift's show in London on Saturday, June 22nd. Imagine being part of the magic, all thanks to Like a Girl Media. Entering is easy. Subscribe, share, and show us which episodes inspired you the most. Visit our website or check our social media for all the details. Don't just dream it, be it. Thrive like a girl and make this summer unforgettable. Contest opens globally, void where prohibited, must be 18 or older to enter, no purchase necessary. Subscribe and share with hashtag Thrive Like a Girl and tag us at likeagirl_media for entry. Unlimited entries means unlimited chances. Winner chosen at random after contest closes May 20th, 2024. Will be notified via DM. Make sure your profiles are not private. Check full rules on our site. This is your shot to see Taylor Swift live. Don't miss it. Hit Like a Girl podcast is a proud member of the Health Podcast Network. One thing I love about working with them is that they're mission-driven, which means that they're dedicated to featuring authoritative shows, hosts, and guests who take on the tough topics in healthcare with empathy, expertise, and a commitment to excellence. If you're looking for bingeable content related to the healthcare industry, they've got more than 8,000 episodes on demand waiting for you. From professional development, the patient voice, digital health, innovation and entrepreneurship, and of course, health IT, they've got you covered. So this is your official invitation to check them out at healthpodcastnetwork.com. Hey there, and welcome to the Hit Like a Girl podcast. My name is Joy Rios, and we celebrate and amplify women who are working and contributing in the health IT space. So I like to think about healthcare as a 30,000 piece puzzle. It is a very complicated space to work in, and we all kind of hold one piece of it. So it is fun to invite women onto our show and talk about their expertise. So if you wouldn't mind taking a moment today to introduce yourself and tell us about the health IT puzzle piece that you hold and where you fit into the big picture.
Absolutely. My name is Anna Basovich. I'm the Vice President of Enterprise Partnerships at Arcadia.
Okay.
And Arcadia is a data platform. And what we do is we work with healthcare organizations to help them aggregate their data and leverage it to improve population health.
You're speaking my love language. Continue.
I am a longtime Arcadian.
Okay.
And I manage the customer-facing work that we do with some of our larger and more complex customers. So these are really large national health plans, okay. Larger regional health systems that in most cases are very advanced in taking risk across commercial, Medicaid, Medicare populations, I get the opportunity to work with some very excited, very passionate leaders, and it's a blast.
So I had a chance to stop by your guys' booth yesterday and was like, oh, give me a little bit of an insight into the kind of data that you guys are tracking for your populations. And I was like, does any of it track into the MIPS area? Are you familiar, sure, with the MIPS program? I'm like, do you want to geek out on that at all for a minute? Like, how can you geek out with me on how your platform, helps people succeed within value-based programs?
Sure. So there's a couple of key areas that we focus on around value-based care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quality, risk adjustment, and cost.
Okay.
So on the quality side, it's about rounding up the data, getting it from claims, but also digging into the EHR systems to get the really comprehensive, as close to real-time as you can get view of what your performance is and what to do about it. And for me, that's always been a huge part of this and where the magic happens in a lot of ways. Is it's one thing to get a report on your performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing to get a really recent report on your performance and not say, hey, here's how you did last year.
No. Here's how you're doing today.
Here's how you're doing today, but also here's what you need to do tomorrow. When we say that you haven't closed enough care gaps on breast cancer screenings, here are the patients you want to bring in. And how do you engage the population really
effectively? Oh, I love that. So can we just stop there for a second? I mean, we can continue geeking out. But so instead of looking at just like, here's your numerator, denominator, and your performance rate, you're just like, here's all the people that you missed it on altogether that may not even be included in the denominator? Is that what you're saying? That you're just like, we could help more people, essentially.
Exactly. That's a huge part of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
Not at all. So there's your quality measures.
Okay.
Then we take a similar view to risk adjustment. And we say, hey, when we talk about coding, let's get out of the part that makes providers say, you know, this isn't why I went to med school. Let's bring it into how to care for patients better. When we talk about a coding gap, what we're really talking about is a condition that's not being managed adequately.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's not writing down the fact that a patient has a condition, it means they're not developing a care plan. They're not evaluating the patient on an ongoing basis. They're not getting a chance to understand what the right next step is there.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people that don't necessarily geek out on coding. So can we,
and risk adjustment? It's a quirky one to geek out on.
No, but it's really an important one. So when we talk about that, when you think of like, and kind of in layman's terms, if somebody hasn't been, you know, if they don't have it in their record that shows that they have a particular condition, to your point, can we talk about like what that actually means? Like how that might impact them as an individual, you know, for them to either not have the, well, like you said, the plan according to like what would be relevant for them. I don't know.
Sure.
Okay.
So what's interesting for me about risk adjustment is that it's very easy to look at it as documenting, and writing exactly the right code year over year. But what it really comes down to is CMS looks to healthcare organizations and Medicare Advantage plans and other entities to really engage meaningfully with patients around this. So it's never about dropping a code.
Mm-hmm.
That's and there's all kinds of audit structures to make sure that's not happening. But the guidance CMS gives is you got to see the patient, and we now know that that can also mean a telehealth visit. But you got to see the patient. You got to evaluate their condition. You've got to understand where the patient is in managing it, and you've got to pull together or update a care plan that's right for that patient based on where they are. And if we're not doing that on a regular basis, we can't expect that patient to be managing that condition effectively on their own.
Well, and that's the thing, that it can reset, right? Like after a year. So if you may have had a particular risk adjustment factor code on an encounter out, you know, a year ago, but if they see the doctor again and it's gone away, you have to, it's an ongoing conversation, correct?
You've got to keep it updated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So we went with those two, and then the other component is the cost category. And combined quality and cost is like the majority of value-based care.
It's the holy grail.
So can we geek out on that, which is also a riveting conversation? Yes.
So when we look at cost and utilization, there's a couple parts to it. There's, again, there's getting health systems more fluent in the language of cost.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we started value-based contracts 5-10 years ago, cost was a thing that health plans dealt with. And up until that point, health systems had been focused on doing the right thing for the patient smack in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it expanded to, okay, well, let's get the patient in the door too. And then maybe let's find some other ways to help them. And total cost of care was such a radical factor to put into these health system contracts, because it said, you know what, you're responsible for what this patient does. When they decide at 2 a.m. to go to an emergency room down the street from you.
Yep.
When they read online that maybe an MRI would be a great idea for that headache.
Yep.
But the reality is that there are so many more nuanced things. And when you talk about cost, it's not about patients deciding to get an expensive procedure. It's about the way that you manage these chronic conditions and the way that they evolve and getting patients the right support at those really critical turning points where when a patient gets discharged from an inpatient stay, we know that that's a turning point. That's an opportunity to engage really effectively with the full scope of that patient's care and drive them and support them in moving towards the right outcomes. And if not, then it can be a situation where the patient becomes a heavy, high-cost utilizer. And that's meaningful from a cost perspective, but it's really meaningful from an outcomes perspective. No patient wants to be in that situation.
Right.
We want to make sure that patients are feeling enabled and empowered in improving their health.
So do you help the providers actually understand how patients get attributed to them? Because that's a conversation that I have faced with a lot of providers. And it is one of the more interesting ones. So I would be curious to hear what your experience in that conversation is like.
It's a big one. And I think what you're getting into also is this broader question of change management and education with providers. Because it's a spot where you've got a lot of opportunity to engage folks that don't want to look at these contracts as moneyball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to do their best taking care of patients. And that's where health systems have the opportunity to put the right care team around them to say, we're going to have our provider focus on delivering the best care to the patient. And that means that we're going to have somebody hitting the phones to get patients in.
Right.
We're going to have care navigators helping the patients get those specialist appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody to make sure that the information from that specialist appointment makes its way right back home to the PCP so they can continue to build out that care plan. We're going to have care managers.
Yes.
And in many cases, we're going to have somebody that looks at that report and reviews it and says, you know, when we talk about inpatient behavioral health spend increasing 7% year over year, what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
Is that mm-hmm. more? Is that more patients needing more care? Is that the same number of patients needing a lot more care? Is that the same number of patients getting the same amount of care
exactly.
at
yeah.
a more expensive facility?
Yeah, I love that. That's great. So mm-hmm. one of the conversations that I have gotten to experience is like working a lot with specialists. And so dermatologists, for example, who may have a patient list of like attributed patients to them of like more than 1,000, you know, and they're just like, why am I responsible for the total cost of care? I had nothing to do with that mm-hmm. patient's hospitalization, hip, you know, surgery or a replacement or anything along those lines, and just helping them to really like have the conversation about making sure that their patients that may be seeing them for a special, like it's that conversation around education of like your those patients may consider you their primary care provider, even though you're technically not a PCP. They are seeing you more than they are seeing their general practitioner. And so making sure that they have, you know, a care manager and asking them those questions and sort of like helping them get engaged in their health system in mm-hmm. a way that is more, well, appropriate, individualized, and just like covering the whole part of their health journey. So that it's not to say that like, hey, we're going to try to make sure that you don't have any attributed patients, that we're not trying to get that down to zero because mm-hmm. that doesn't make sense. But ultimately, how do you educate them so that it's the right patients that are on that list, that it's appropriate and it makes sense? And nobody likes having that conversation. It's fun and not, I mean, it's not that fun, but we try to make it as fun as possible.
It can be a really dry discussion, a lot of playing. Well, you had 4 visits versus 7 over here. But the neat thing is it's a really good opportunity for that value-based care infrastructure
yeah.
that health systems establish that can really help guide and can make some of those calls, because one organization might say, you know what? I don't think a dermatologist should necessarily be the guy on point.
Right.
For a patient's total cost of care. Great, what about a cardiologist? Should it be a cardiologist by himself? Should it always be a partnership mm-hmm. with general medicine or internal mm-hmm. medicine? What are the different options there? And it's really interesting for me to watch the role of the specialist evolve
mm-hmm.
as we think about how do they, in so many cases, step beyond that visit by visit that's been traditional and a lot more entrenched. And how do accountable care organizations engage them effectively?
Yeah, so does Arcadia provide education and resources to help them understand all of that? Like, it's one thing, here's a bunch of data, but here's how you interpret it and understand it and how it impacts you and what meaning it has?
So what we're typically doing is we, and my team in particular, is working directly with the operational and clinical and technical and analytical leadership
okay.
on the customer side.
Okay.
And a lot of our goal is empowering our customers to take ownership of that.
Okay.
Because especially when you look at our enterprise partnerships, which is our larger health systems,
mm-hmm.
we want to make sure that those folks are really equipped to grow in an agile and self-sufficient way. So I'll give you a small example, but we run a train-the-trainer model. I personally actually love training. It's a little bit of my work hobby. And if someone asked me to go in and train a bunch of providers on using some of our point of care tools, you would probably have to hold me back a little bit.
Okay.
But one of the things that I'll always point out to our customers is I don't want you guys to have to call me every time you hire someone.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that you guys have really full ownership of the best ways to use our tools and the ways that are best for your organization.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, can you tell me a little bit more about your personal journey? Like, did you know that you were, did you have your eyes set on your current career when you were younger? Like, did you know out of college this is what you were going to do?
I didn't.
Okay.
So both my parents are software engineers.
Okay.
And what they were embarrassed to hear me say coming out of high school was, I don't want to do software because that's boring. You just have to tell the computer what to do. And that sounds lame. I want to be, You know, I want to be an architect, I want to be a psychiatrist. I had a very long list of things. And I was very lucky a few years out of school that I landed at Arcadia, which at the time was a small consulting company that was really zeroing in on healthcare.
Okay.
And it was a very neat opportunity to work with a number of health plans and health systems, as well as a number of other organizations in the space, to get a good understanding of what it means to deliver care and what's everything that happens behind that curtain. Mm-hmm. When you think about a patient having a doctor's visit or a series of them or ending up in the ER, what's everything that can be done behind the curtain to improve that process?
Was there anything in particular that when you landed in Arcadia that is like, a lot of people, really my question comes from when we, a lot of folks when they get into healthcare, they realize like, wow, I can really make a difference here, or it's really impactful the work that I'm doing. Did you have anything specific that like, you were like, oh yeah, this is my place, you know?
You know, I think the piece that comes to mind is there was an article in the New York Times maybe a decade or so back. And it was talking about the way that different companies use analytics. And the example that it gave is a company like Target will run all of this complex analytics to figure out what to market to you next. And they had a hilarious situation where a young woman, a teenager, received a mailer from Target advertising products that are appropriate for a second semester of pregnancy. And her father stormed into Target furiously, waving this little slick.
How dare
you insinuate this about my child? But sure enough, his daughter was in the midst of a teen pregnancy, and her own, you know, Target knew before her family because she was purchasing things that were consistent with what women in the first trimester purchase. And all I could think was reading that was, my God, I bet her PCP didn't know. I bet Target knew before her primary care physician. What if healthcare had those kinds of tools?
Mm-hmm.
And that got me really excited.
I remember that. That was like, it was all over the news when it happened. I was just like, it's true. And it just is like mind blowing because mm-hmm. you're like, oh my God, these places that we shop, they know so much about us and so much more than like our closest loved ones, the people mm-hmm. in our family, the people who are supposed to be taking care of us, etc. And it is kind of mind blowing. It's just like, there's a lot of data and the way that it can be used is just getting more and more powerful like as we go. Mm-hmm. So how are you guys using your data for good?
So a lot of the data that we use is really geared towards helping health systems and plans determine the right next action.
Okay.
And a lot of that is looking at impact and where can you make the biggest difference. I'll give you one example that I really like is as part of patient stratification, there's a ton of risk scores that you can look at, right? Okay. And we can geek out on this one for a while too. But there's a lot of ways to say, you know, this is the patient who is going to have the greatest cost. This is the patient with the heaviest disease burden and all the different ways of looking at that. And one of the stratification methodologies that we run is our care management impact score, which is not just which patient is going to have the highest cost, but which patient is going to have the highest cost that's impactable by care management. So where are those special spots where you have a turning point?
Mm-hmm.
You have a pivot where a patient can get better or they can get worse, and that's an area that you, as a health system, can make a really meaningful impact in. And that's one of the things that's so valuable for me, because you think about somebody like a care manager that in many cases is, you know, sitting now at home, previously in their cube, and they're hitting the phone and they're working so hard to engage with patients, working through a series of complexities and barriers. So for me, beyond the fact that, you know, all of these things add up and it's a total cost and it's about how much money you make in that MA contract, mm-hmm. there's a really neat angle of what are the places where that person can make a difference? What are the places where that person isn't just running their playbook and kind of checking off the boxes on what to say, but what are the spots where that person can talk to a patient and make a real difference in that person's life?
So what are some of those pivot points? Like, is there a report that is just like, here's the list of mm-hmm. patients, like what would be the thing that you're dialing in on, for example, or one of the things that you might dial in on?
It's the question I always ask, and I'm always reminded that machine learning means it's always chugging along and figuring it out. But some of the things that we look for, right, there's inpatient admissions. So we know that a patient that's hitting the hospital on a regular basis, that's not their idea of a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer there isn't that, hey, we want them to stop going to the hospital. It's that we want them to start getting a different kind of care.
Yeah.
Emergency room utilization, huge driver, particularly for looking at chronic condition evolution, narcotics abuse, number of other areas, behavioral health crises. Again, these are patients who should be getting a different and frankly more appropriate level of care in a different setting. Mm-hmm. Those are a number of them. One of the other pieces that I've always been really proud that we've incorporated into that since its start is socioeconomic factors. Mm-hmm. Where are the places where you can help patients deliver health literacy? You know, as you think about these chronic disease management programs, you see folks asking very frequently, how well do you understand your diagnosis? Do you feel like you understand your care plan? Do you understand your medications and why you're taking them? Because that's such a huge component of enabling a patient.
Yeah, those are great questions. And then when, depending on their answers, you can point them to resources, I'm hoping.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. That's great. I need to spend more time with our cardiac. Can you tell me a little bit more about your journey? Like I like to ask, did 10-year-old or 8-year-old you know what you wanted to do? Or what would 8-year-old you think about what you're doing now for a living?
I think she'd be a little bit surprised but kind of excited about it. You know, so I came to Arcadia as a business analyst about 15 years ago. And, you know, my background had been in consulting. I've done time at Deloitte. And I had an opportunity to work with a lot of our customers and really just dig into the problems that they were facing. And I became an implementation manager and an account manager. And one of the things that's been exciting for me is I've had a chance to wear a lot of different hats on the way that we implement technology for our customers, mm-hmm. but also the way that they roll it out, the way that they really make it effective, and really looking at the ways that several different organizations that work with different populations, that have different internal structures, that are or aren't hospital-based, for example, that they can engage around similar-looking problems in different ways that make more sense for them.
Got it. So if solving problems is definitely one of your strong points, what advice would you give for women entering their career? And if they are trying to solve the problem of just like, what do I do with my life? You know, right? Like, it's different for everyone's journey is different, but is there anything that, you know, you've learned along yours that you think would be supportive or helpful for somebody else kind of starting theirs?
You know, one of the biggest things that I like to ask is, of the things in front of you on any given day, where can you make the greatest impact? Mm-hmm. And there's this career advice that I know I got in college, I'm sure other folks have, which is do what you love.
Yes.
And it's great in theory, but God, 21-year-old me didn't know what I loved.
No.
It's about getting out there and starting to get your hands into things and figuring out where you can drive real improvement. Mm-hmm. And it can take you in really unexpected directions. And, you know, frankly, I find myself sometimes working a lot closer to the technology than what 8-year-old or 30-year-old me might have expected.
Yeah.
But it's about, you know, it's about really making sure that you're communicating effectively, that you're understanding what the folks around you are trying to accomplish, and seeing how you can move your work forward in a really meaningful way.
And I think sometimes that can be in a surprising way. And so mm-hmm. sometimes when people follow what they love, they may like love scuba diving, they may love rock climbing, they may love reading, right? Or like playing Pokemon Go, like who mm-hmm. knows? But in different ways that they can actually learn skills from those and take them and apply them to their career. Is there anything that you have, you know, followed your passion in that is not necessarily healthcare related, but have you like enjoyed and been able to apply to your work?
Oh, what a good question. Let me see what I can think of there. I mean, you know, I think engaging with data in new ways is definitely one of them. I'll give you an example. We were running patient outreach programs. Particularly during COVID.
Okay.
And it was a really interesting engagement. And it was pretty different than a lot of the work that we'd done before. But it was something that we'd had in our back pocket for some time. And when COVID hit, we realized that there was a really important opportunity for patient engagement because we were all, you know, watching TV all day long and scrolling through Twitter. And we were kind of saying, okay, well, there's kind of a mix of information out there and some of this doesn't look very good. What if this was coming from providers? What if it was coming from health systems? And one of the things that I had a chance to do over the couple months there of running those programs was really start to dig into the data on that and take a look at, you know, how well are messages getting delivered?
Okay.
What are the responses that come back from patients? How are populations impacted by that? And that was a piece where, you know, in a lot of ways, I was digging through outreach data. It wasn't, you know, I probably could have been doing the same thing with Target's mailers or something like that.
But does it come in different forms? You're just like, is it like text messaging, email, social media, DMs? Like, in what way would you be interacting with that type of data?
You know, a lot of it was text messages. Okay. And a lot of it is what happens when you text 100,000 people about how to stay safe during COVID.
Yeah.
What do they text you
back?
That's
what I want to know. What do they text
you
back?
Oh my God, it's a range.
Okay.
It's a huge range. And it's really interesting because you learn that, you know, you get patients that are asking for help. You get patients that need very specific things. You get folks who say, you know, hey, I'm running low on my medication and my practice is closed. How do I get a refill? And that's the kind of thing where, well, gee, you would have thought that they just call their PCP office. But that's the medium that they're now engaging on, and that's where you got to meet them at.
Right.
There's a lot of other feedback. You start to see some of the misinformation that's out there start to come through. And it really helps you understand, again, where that population is at and what are the challenges that you need to address there.
Mm-hmm. I love it. That must have been a really interesting project to work
on.
And keeping you busy during a weird time.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today. If people want to follow you, get in touch with you, or follow your work in your organization, where would you point them?
Look me up on LinkedIn, Anna Basevich, and feel free to reach out. I am always happy to geek out on this stuff.
I love geeking out. Thanks for geeking out with me.
You too.
And thank you for watching. This has been the Hit Like a Girl podcast, and you can follow us on social media at Hit Like a Girl Pod. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Chirpy Bird, Inc. CMS's Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, or MIPS, is super complex. And if clinicians ignore the program or perform poorly in it, it can result in a hit to their revenue and reputation. Chirpy Bird is proud to say that more than 95% of its clients are exceptional performers in MIPS, meaning they've maximized the score that directly translates into their Medicare reimbursement rate. Chirpy Bird offers their audit-proof services to practices of all sizes through an affordable monthly subscription that includes unlimited access to a regulatory expert who guides them in knowing what data to track, how to create workflows that make capturing that data easier, and ensures that they submit it all to CMS on time and performing at its best. Contact Chirpy Bird today or learn more at chirpybirdinc.com. That's chirpybirdinc.com.